From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and a great nation that is seeing a lot of whiplash, a lot of back and forth and zigs and zags on many different policies that are being dramatically changed by the new administration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But in no area is that contrast between the Trump administration and the Biden administration more striking than in terms of policy toward Iran. The president of the United States has just appointed, or his secretary of state, Antony Blinken, has just appointed a negotiator for dealing with Iran who is known as an extreme leftist and one of those people who believes that basically appeasement is the way to deal with an problem and an aggressive regime, a nightmare regime like Iran. To talk about everything that's happening and the often unheralded role of demographics, he wrote a fascinating piece about that. Michael Rubin, who has his PhD, at least partially in terms of analysis of Iran. And he's also a resident scholar at American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes in Iran, Turkey, and the broader Middle East. He also teaches classes at sea about Middle East conflicts, culture, terrorism, and the Horn of Africa to deployed U.S. Navy and Marine units. Dr. Rubin, always great to speak to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what a pleasure. First of all, I was shocked, and I didn't realize it until I read your piece, that Rob Malley, who I remember very well and know all about, he truly is someone who is not at all sympathetic to Israel, and he seems to be much more sympathetic to the radicals in the Arab world. What the heck is he doing being designated our new emissary to Iran?
Well, that's a question which we have to ask President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken. But remember, I mean, Rob Malley has a world vision, which to his credit, he has never tried to hide. He almost was bypassed for a job in the Obama administration when it emerged that he had been meeting previous to his appointment with Hamas in order to try to normalize that terrorist group. His attitude towards Iran is similar. He tends to believe that the root of the problem between Iran and the United States is solely the United States, and that if we only appease enough, if we only give enough carrots, that Iran will somehow come around. I'm not sure where that philosophy has ever borne fruit, but Malley truly does believe it.
Okay, you make a point in one of your papers on Iran, and we're going to access them at our website at michaelmedved.com so people can find out for themselves, because this is very important stuff. You make the point that a lot of people want to say that, well, the choice between the conservative position and the Biden position is the choice between diplomacy and war. And you make the point, no, it's a choice between the kind of diplomacy that's going to actually avoid war and the kind of diplomacy that's going to lead to war. Explain.
Well, we've actually, the key point, Michael, is that the Iranians have a vote on this too. And we have a long history of the Islamic Republic of Iran's behavior, that when concessions are offered too forthrightly, oftentimes what they conclude is that they can extract greater concessions through worse behavior. And this can actually lead to a deterioration in the relationship. That's what I worry most about. I mean, take, for example, after the Biden administration reversed the Foreign Terrorist Organization designation on the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and that they're an Iranian proxy, of course, what the Houthis immediately did was launch an attack which set on fire an airliner on the tarmac in a Saudi civilian airport. Likewise, what we've seen more recently with Iran is further attacks in Iraq as we up our concessions towards the Islamic Republic of Iran. The problem is that while the Biden administration wants to see reformers dominating Iran, it's actually the security sectors, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which are unelected, which control all the apparatuses of power, which pursue policies of concern to us, and more importantly, controls the Iranian economy. So any foreign money that goes into Iran doesn't benefit ordinary Iranians. It goes directly into the bank accounts of the group which funds terror.
Okay. People, I think, have prayed, hoped for, planned for some kind of regime change in Iran. And obviously the grand Ayatollah, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is he's in his 80s, isn't he?
He's 81 years old. He's a cancer survivor, and he's partially paralyzed.
Uh-huh. So what's the best scenario? Maybe start with that. And then what's the worst scenario in terms of the United States' relationship with Iran for, say, the next 2 years?
Well, what's clear is that there is going to be regime change inside Iran. We're going to have nothing to do with it because Ayatollahs live a long life, but they do eventually die. And the question is, how smooth will that succession be? If you talk to Iranians, there's two main contenders. One is Mojtaba Khamenei, who's the son of the current supreme leader, and the other is a young radical named Ibrahim Raisi, who actually heads the judiciary and used to head this multi-billion-dollar conglomerate out in the second-largest city of Mashhad. Now, the point here is that there will be a struggle, and oftentimes when we have these sorts of struggles, people try to build legitimacy for themselves by showing who can sponsor the most spectacular terrorist attack. But there's also a problem that perhaps there's not going to be a smooth transition and that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps will take control. Then the question becomes, is this going to be an ordinary military dictatorship, or is it simply going to streamline the process through which military actions can be taken, given that the Revolutionary Guard is ideological and they look at the United States as their enemy number one?
Okay, so given the fact of regime change, how solid do you think the new agreement that President Biden is pursuing would likely be?
Well, I don't think it's going to be very very solid. First of all, it's wishful thinking to believe that we can simply go back to the 2015 nuclear deal. And the reason why it's wishful thinking is built into that deal were expiration clauses, sunset clauses, in which certain restrictions would expire over time. And so the Iranians aren't going to go back to the status quo ante. Now, one of the major concerns we have is actually with Iran's missile program. And recently, there's been some statements where the Iranians have more or less admitted that their satellite program is actually cover for a nuclear missile program. They talked, for example, about how their latest test launch was a satellite launch capable missile that was mobile. It could be launched from mobile missiles using solid fuel. That's something which satellites don't need. That's something which nuclear weapons do need. The issue is, in order to address that, the Biden administration seems prepared to give the Iranians loads of more incentives. The question is, what will the Iranians do with those incentives? We tend to look at peace talks and diplomacy as how to get to yes, coming to a win-win situation, where the Iranians too often look at this in terms of asymmetric warfare. Let's let our adversaries use diplomacy to tie themselves in a knot while we pursue our own agendas. And indeed, when you look at the Persian language debates in the Iranian press, they talk about that strategy openly.
It's all sobering. You should read about it. Michael Rubin, thank you for your enlightenment and for your pieces, which we have posted at our website. Coming up, guess who's a victim of oppression here in the United States? A multimillionaire celebrity. Tell you which one.
Daily right dose of debate.
You're trying to stir up some controversy.
The Michael Medved Show.
No controversy, really, almost none, but none that I'm aware of, about Relief Factor, which is a dietary supplement that can make a very positive difference in your life at a truly minimal cost. I mean, 95 cents a day to reduce your pain and discomfort, make you more able, more ready and eager to enjoy a sunny day like today. Yeah, Relief Factor. Just 95 cents a day for a quick start. That's $19.95 for 3 whole weeks. You will notice the difference. Almost 3/4 of the people who get a quick start do and order more Relief Factor. Good, healthy stuff. Nothing to lose but your pain and the whole world to gain. Go to michaelmedved.com and click on the banner for Relief Factor. Less than a cup of coffee a day for pain relief. Okay, I don't know what the appropriate relief is here from Madonna. But Madonna wants you to know that she is being oppressed. She sent out the following message. The patriarchy continues to try to crush my neck with their heavy boots, cut off my life force, and take away my voice. Even those who call themselves artists, you know who you are. Death to the patriarchy, now and forever. Well, wait, death is kind of final. How do you do now and forever when you're wishing death to somebody? If somebody can explain what she means or what she has in mind by death to the patriarchy, I would love to hear it. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Look, the celebrity culture is so weird and strange, and people end up believing such bizarre stuff. And I was actually moved by some of this regarding some of the celebrity reactions by celebrities, obviously. Celebrity reaction by celebrities, that makes sense, right? To the death of Rush Limbaugh a week ago. And they compiled a list over at the Media Research Center of soulless celebrities react to Limbaugh's passing. And there's a tweet by Ron Perlman, who, of course, probably best known as the star of Hellboy. And he tweeted out, me being Hellboy, N, then S word, and having spent so much time in Hades, I would like to extend my deepest sympathies to the poor devil who will no doubt have to spend the rest of eternity with Rush Limbaugh. That was on the same day that he died, that his wife, Catherine, went on his own national radio show to announce that he was gone after a courageous battle with lung cancer, where whatever you feel about Rush or his ideas or the way he spoke or any of that, the fact that he kept at it, getting there every day whenever he could to try to do his show, even when desperately ill, I think indicated that, yes, he did take his role as something more serious than just an entertainer. And actor George Takei, best known, of course, from Star Trek, tweeted out, a great symbol of rot, avarice, and American carnage has finally left us. The moment met with sublime satisfaction by millions around the world. Yes, I'm talking Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino being imploded. What did you think I was talking about? And that actually was his tweet shortly after the death of Rush was announced. And then Bette Midler tweeted, hashtag Rush Limbaugh has gone to his reward. Bet it's hot. And then she got angry tweets back in response from that, including one from Newt Gingrich. And then she responded to that. She said, no, Newt, his birth was a tragic moment. He was one of the vilest reptiles who ever trolled the planet. And of course, birds of a feather, Newt, mend your ways, lest your death bring the outpouring of joy so many feel at his demise. Okay, I have a question for you, and I may be forgetting something, but I was truly trying to think of it. Can anyone think of another instance where a liberal icon, somebody who was beloved by people on the center left in America, passed away, and there were conservatives who were cackling and said, oh, yeah, ha, going straight to hell. Boy, it's going to be hot for him. That's a I don't remember that. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and she was certainly a liberal icon, there was respect from everyone. And I know that when we talked about it on the show, you recognized that she may have had an interpretation of the Constitution that I strongly disagreed with. She had a whole series of political ideas I strongly disagree with, but she was, according to all accounts, a nice lady. I think she was devoted to her job. She had many admirable qualities, which people recognized. I don't remember anyone treating the passing of Justice Ginsburg with anything other than respect. Or John Lewis, who's a real hero to the left. And yeah, I'd love to think of a talk show host, but there was no talk show host on the left like Rush, who inspired millions of followers. And again, if there's someone out there who can think of a time where there was a left-wing hero, and I'm talking about an American. I'm not talking about the death of evil dictators abroad. I'm talking about somebody here in the United States who left-wing people admired greatly. Has there been a case where conservatives have danced on the grave? And, I mean, even some of the mainstream commentary about Rush, Dana Milbank in the on MSNBC, he's a Washington Post columnist, he said, before there was Rush, there was Ronald Reagan, there was Barry Goldwater. What Rush brought to the table was the attitude of hatred, the notion of moving the Republican Party and the conservative movement away from being a cooperating participant in American democracy to being an opponent of democracy. Where has the right ever responded to the passing of a left-wing hero in this way? There are profound differences between left and right. We will get to more of them coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
And talking about differences between left and right, there is a big news study that talks about how that old assumption that conservatives were conservatives because they were more fearful of the world. We will get to that in just a moment. There's an amazing piece that was sent to me. It's a very, very good piece that was done at a website called The Post Millennial, which I had been unfamiliar with. But it has a picture of a good friend of mine, and so I wanted to share the piece. And it points out in a piece by a website, following the passing of Rush Limbaugh, conservative icon and talk radio broadcaster, the New York Times obituary identified Limbaugh's producer as an enigmatic, possibly made-up person, as implied by the paper's description of the man, referring to him as an unheard voice of someone he called Bo Snerdly. This is what Rush wrote, what they wrote about Rush in the actual wording of their obituary. And it's so funny because James Golden has been a guest on my show many times. He was a guest on our show 2 days after Rush's passing. He had been Rush's producer for more than 30 years. He had been Rush's producer since 1988. So it's a very, very long, profound relationship. And it's worth noting that James Golden, who was referred to as Bo Snerdly by Rush, and that was just sort of one of his joking habits, Bo Snerdly's black. And he's very real. He's not made up. He's a big guy, in fact. Here's what they wrote in the New York Times in the obituary. Unlike Howard Stern, Don Imus, and other big names in shock radio, Mr. Limbaugh had no on-the-air sidekicks, though he had conversations with the unheard voice of someone he called Bo Snerdly. Nor did he have writers, scripts, or outlines, just notes and clippings from newspapers he perused daily. And then they bring up here in the post-millennial, far from being a fiction of Limbaugh's apparently broad imagination, a quick Google search for Bo Snerdly brings up Bo Snerdly, the pseudonym of James Golden, Rush's screener, producer, and engineer. Wikipedia states that Golden, a.k.a. Bo Snerdly, quote, has been a producer executive for Premier Networks, the largest radio syndication company in the United States, since 2001. He actually had worked with Rush long before that, for 12 years before that. So it's understated in Wikipedia. Imagine that. In any event, Golden is, it should be noted, they write over here, post-millennial, a black man, making this yet another instance of the anti-racist, in quotes, liberal media erasing a successful black man. Try to imagine if this were reversed, if this were some liberal hero who had as his primary assistant a proudly African-American individual. And in writing about this person, no one mentioned him. No one talked about him at all. And by the way, that is true. I read nearly all of the liberal obituaries about Rush. Not one of them mentioned James Golden, who was a huge part of Rush's life. He even had a place down in Florida, not too far away from where Rush lived. And it's just completely outrageous. And you can imagine that if it were conservative media that were erasing the role of a very strong, opinionated, and extremely persuasive black public figure, just erasing the role, saying, well, maybe he exists, maybe he doesn't, maybe it's just a disembodied voice, there's no voice there, he just talks to him. Okay, if it were someone on the right who were doing that, the term racism would be used. It was racist. How could you eliminate that figure from any consideration? Just worth considering. Piece in Live Science, which actually looks at a whole series of surveys and polls and studies, and they ask a question: are conservatives more afraid of threats than liberals? Political psychologists have long found evidence that people on the right are more sensitive to scary stuff on average than people on the left, a basic psychological difference thought to drive some political disagreements between the two groups. But new research suggests that's overly simplistic. In a new international study, conservatives and liberals both responded to threats, but they responded more strongly to different kinds of threats. And to make matters more complex, those responses don't always map nicely onto the political divide or stay consistent from nation to nation. For instance, what's not consistent from nation to nation, for conservatives, conservatives are a little bit more afraid of government here in the United States. Conservatives are more afraid of terrorism. Conservatives are not more afraid of space aliens. They're not more afraid of climate change. It depends what it is. And by the way, conservatives, liberals, everybody is more afraid of government in Russia. And with reason. They say people physiologically prone to fear and disgust would pay more attention to threats and thus turn to a conservative political ideology that promises safety and the status quo. That at least was a theory. But the link between threats and politics can run both ways. For example, a recent Politico poll found that 70% of Republicans thought the 2020 election was marred by fraud, compared with only 10% of Democrats. But before the election, 35% of Republicans thought the election would be fraudulent, and 52% of Democrats did. In other words, Democrats were more likely to expect the election would be fraudulent than Republicans were. And what they're saying here is that your politics can affect your level of fear at least as much as your level of fear can affect your politics. For people who look at pronouncements of the end of the world, I think that both sides were profoundly afraid of what would happen if the other side won in this election. And that leads to a point that I think is very important for conservatives to acknowledge, which is that we should have more faith in America. Really, we should. The United States of America, I am sure, will survive the Biden administration. That's not to say the Biden administration may not do damage. They may do damage. Hope not. But just as I would assure liberals, the United States survived the Trump administration. It wasn't the end of the world. Before that, we survived Obama. He was not the last president we ever had. Before that, yes, liberals, we even survived Bush. The United States is not just a few steps away from destruction. However, that idea that we are is actually hurting us abroad. A very smart commentator talks about how the idea that Americans put forward, that America is on the ropes, that America is finished, America is ruined, is damaging us profoundly, economically, militarily, in every way. Come to more coming up.
Michael Medved.
On the Michael Medved Show, I do think there's a tendency in this country to worry too much about what some nations abroad may think of us. But you can't entirely just dispense with it. I do believe that President Biden was making an attempt. He spoke recently via the internet, of course, via, I don't know, it's some fancy form of Zoom, I guess, to the Munich Security Conference, where he was speaking directly to Europe, and his whole theme was America is back, and we're going to recognize that our alliance with Europe is very important. The truth of the matter, says William Galston in the Wall Street Journal, is that for the Europeans, for a lot of European leaders like Macron and Merkel and others, even Boris Johnson, they don't really care that America's back, because apparently the faith in America, the confidence in America, the dependence on America is much less. This is one of the things in which, without question, President Trump had some real success in this sense. He persuaded most European countries to spend more on their own defense, to increase their defense budgets, precisely because he said, no, you can't depend on America. Now they've gotten the message. 61% of Europeans believe they can't count on the United States because our political system is broken. This figure includes 66% of the French, 71% of Germans, and remarkably, 81% of Brits. 81% of Brits think our political system is broken. In such a system, a gridlock and drift are the most likely outcomes in terms of the relationship with Europe. In Europe's eyes, America decline coincides with China's rise. 59% of Europeans, including 56% of Germans, 58% of the British, and 62% of the French, believe that within 10 years, China will displace the U.S. as the world's leading power. Now, people who are actually scholars of military matters, of economies, that's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. Our GDP, even with a considerably smaller population, population is less than one-fourth of China's, our GDP is still vastly higher. It's still, and the United States remains the dominant power in the world. But China will displace the U.S. as the world's leading power. This helps explain why in a case of disagreement between the U.S. and China, 60% of Europeans believe that their country should remain neutral, compared with only 22% who say they should take America's side. Is that astonishing? And you talk about a disagreement between the U.S. and China. Would that include, like, defending Taiwan against a Chinese invasion? Defending Japan and its interests? This stance extends to the threat from Russia. Amid tension between the U.S. and Russia, which seized the Crimea and threatens Ukraine's territorial integrity, 59% prefer neutrality, while only 23% want to cast their lot with Americans. Astonishingly, the polls, the most anti-Russian people in Europe, maybe the most anti-Russian people in the world, and they have good reason to be, the polls opt for neutrality, overtaking the U.S. side. They say as perceptions of American weakness mount, more Europeans are starting to favor being tougher on the U.S. on economic issues. Well, that doesn't help. And part of the difficulty saying the U.S. is in trouble, I think, has to do with the fact that every problem that ever turns up in the U.S. and claims of a fraudulent election and the attack on the Capitol, we all exaggerate everything, don't we? I mean, making this the end of the world? And it doesn't help America's position. I'll tell you what helps America's position and American perspective is looking at some of the problems of other world powers. For instance, take India. This report from the New York Times. Indian students were hitting the books hard in preparation for a big test on cows. Reading that India's cows have more emotions than foreign ones, and that their humps have special supernatural powers. But facing widespread ridicule, this weekend the government abruptly postponed the first exam based on a new curriculum pushed by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government. Students in public universities and in public schools had been asked to bone up on material that scientists and others dismissed as baseless. They accused the government of promoting religious pseudoscience about cows, which Hinduism considers sacred to unwitting students. This is very weird, this exam, said Komai Srivastava, an official for the India Knowledge and Science Society, a nonprofit educational group. They can say anything about cows. They say that radiation is reduced by cow dung. By the way, that's not true. Many academics see the fact that a government body tried to push a curriculum on cows, one that included many completely unsubstantiated claims. The study material in the new course was designed by the Cow Commission, which falls under the Ministry of Animal Husbandry and Dairying. The material has chapters on cow entrepreneurship and sayings from Hindu scriptures. The course delves into breed improvements, bioenergy from cow dung, pesticides, medicine from cow urine. Yum. The concept of promoting cow tourism, using cow dung instead of plaster of Paris for ecological reasons, and the difference between Indian and foreign cows. The Indian cow, or Zebu, does differ from the cow breeds familiar in the West. The Zebu, easily recognized by its big shoulder hump and pronounced dewlap or flap of skin on its neck, is more tolerant of heat and drought and more resistant to some diseases, though it produces less milk. The material that students were asked to absorb for the exam, however, made baseless claims, like one that said inside the hump of that Indian cow, there is a solar pulse which is known to absorb vitamin D from the sun's rays and release it in its milk. Humpless Jersey cows, the material said, don't have such powers. Another part of the curriculum said that indigenous cows were emotional toward humans and other living beings, but that foreign cows had none of these feelings to be exhibited. Indian cows are alert and strong. The material said that foreign cows are lazy. You calling American cows lazy? Purish Kumar, an official at the commission, said it wanted only to educate people on cows, benefits other than milk, and share its scientific findings. He said that any student was free to take the exam. Already 500,000 people had registered, some from abroad, including the United States, to learn about the magical radiation abilities of cow humps in India. Now, look, this doesn't mean that India isn't a wonderful U.S. ally. It doesn't mean that it is not a great and ancient culture. It is all of those things. It is also the world's largest democracy. And you can say that India has done a tremendous job, and they have. In the last 20 years, there are literally hundreds of millions of people who've been brought out of poverty in India. It's a great nation. But paying a little bit more attention to what goes on there and some of the problems in that world's largest democracy, it's one of the reasons that it is important, and I try to do some of this on the show, to sometimes look abroad, because focusing on America exclusively, it's much easier to assume it's all gloom and doom and destruction, or to accept the Madonna viewpoint that the patriarchy is oppressing her and everybody else. Meanwhile, the Biden administration apparently is thinking of pushing a new law. Well, of course, because liberals respond to everything by pushing a new law to make domestic terrorism a federal crime. This is dividing liberals. We will get to why that is. There's also the idea that the Republican Party is going through an identity crisis, and all kinds of news about the way that this coming election, the one in 2022, is shaping up to be a truly, truly epic opportunity for conservatives. And how do you make the most of it? We will get to that and to much more in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.